My name is Bob Garrell, and I am an alcoholic. By the grace of a very loving God who seems to be crazy about me and has no taste at all, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as they're outlined in this book, good sponsorship and a commitment to this program, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substances since Halloween 1978, and for that I owe you my life. It's good to be here. I'd like to open with a little prayer that, if you just bear with me. Lord, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much-needed new experience in my own recovery. Amen. I'm delighted to be here. This is one of the things I do a lot of things in AA. This is one of the things I enjoy the most. This and hospital and institution work. And I've done workshops since the beginning of the 80s, and I've done them with a lot of people. And the guy that I'm doing it with this weekend, I like doing it with more than anybody. And it's a real privilege. Do we seem to click? That's the nicest thing I will say about him all weekend.
I'm amazed you're not having
the truth. How many people have never been to a weekend like this that's focused just on the big book and the steps?
Oh, wow.
Welcome. There's an old friend of mine in Al-Anon. She used to say, I'm here to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. And maybe we'll do a little bit of that this weekend. How many people here are within their first year of abstinence?
Wow.
Welcome. I'm really glad you're here. How many people here in their last year of abstinence? Very few people admit that. I mean, because you'll be deluged by people trying to help you if you admitted that. I mean, I'm not going to speak for Scott. I'm not an expert on the big book, really. If I'm an expert on anything, it's failure. I'm an expert on failure. But I'm a guy who relapsed in Alcoholics Anonymous for quite a few years. And I couldn't stay sober. And not from a lack of trying. I know what it's like to make up my mind and really mean at this time that I can't do this anymore. And then 7 or 8 months later, I'm back at it again. And I tried everything in Alcoholics Anonymous to help me accept the process in this book. And then finally, I started implementing some of the actions in here in my life, and my life started to change. And it is my experience that if you do that, something happens to you. And something wakes up inside you, and as a result of that, you just have this desire to share it with other people. It's very similar to what happened to me the first time I ever got high. I thought, oh man, I wanted to go home and get my parents high. I wanted to get everybody. This is great. And Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been that enthusiastic about this for a lot of years. And we're going to, I'm going to introduce Scott. He's going to talk for a little bit, and I'll probably talk for a little bit. We're going to break about every hour, give or take, a couple minutes, within close to every hour, because it is our experience that what the mind can't absorb, what the butt can't endure. So we're going to break this, but that's Scott.
Good evening. My name is Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic. And, absolutely overwhelmed to be here. What a gift. I, too, have the privilege of doing a lot of things in AA, and this is my single favorite, tied also with taking meetings into jails and institutions. But this isn't too different from that, is it? It's the same group that just happened to be out right now. And I'd like to ask for a show of hands of members of Al-Anon. Are there Al-Anons here? Thank you so much. We are so honored by your presence. My wife has a dynamite Al-Anon program, or I couldn't live the fabulous life that I live. I really do honor you deeply. And if there are members of other fellowships that we haven't mentioned, I'm also very thrilled that you're here. And I don't want to single you out, but thank you. And I, too, am not an expert. I'm a student of this, and I'm here just to kind of share what I have been given. I am continuously sober since June the 28th of 1984. As a direct result, I've been the victim of great sponsorship, and I'm going to talk a lot about that this weekend, that I got here locked up, and what you've taught me is to open up to receive the gifts that have always been here. It's never been God's unwillingness to give. It's been my inability to receive. And that's, for me, kind of a summation of what we're going to cover this weekend. I like to open what I do with a quotation from Lois Wilson, co-founder of Al-Anon, who was asked one time what she did in the moment of silence, and she said, "I invite God to the meeting." And it's not that I don't believe God's here. I do believe God's here, but my great mentor, Don, taught me a long time ago. He said he had learned to treat God like a gentleman. Gentlemen don't go where they're not invited, and they don't stay where they're not made welcome. And so it's my job, I believe, to each morning invite God into my life and to do the things during the day that I believe will make him welcome. And that really kind of sums it up. So in a couple of minutes, I'm going to ask for a moment of silence. I'm going to ask everyone here if you would be so kind as to invite your God to join us. With this many new people, I'm so thrilled to see you. Could be there's someone here who doesn't have a God, or you get one you're afraid of, or something that's simply not working. If that's your situation, I'd like to invite you to borrow mine for this time that we're here this weekend. Let's take a look at page 46 in the text. Bob and I will always be talking about the big book unless we tell you it's another book. We've got 12 and 12s up here. I've got Dr. Bob and the good old timers. We may touch on some other things, but primarily going to be the big book. Paragraph begins at the bottom of page 46 with the word much. If you count three lines above that, halfway over to the right, it says, "It was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God." So I refer to the God of my limited understanding, and that's the truth. So my wife says if God were small enough for me to understand, he wouldn't be big enough to handle some of the things I'm going to need for him to handle. So this is not about me understanding God. When we talk in steps 3 and 11, that's about I don't have to believe what anybody else ever told me. So if you want to borrow my God, you can address him as the God of Scott's limited understanding. The other thing that I do in the moment of silence is I ask God to help me not judge any of the speakers. Now, you don't have to do that, of course. Boy, it sure has made the meetings better everywhere for me, though. You do whatever works for you. And let's take a couple of moments and acknowledge the presence of deity and ask for open hearts. And I'll meet you back here in just a second. Serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I want to start by taking one of my favorite concepts in the big book, and I call it chasing it through the book. We're going to start toward the back, 143, and find the same concept on about five different pages. I think when the book tells me something once, it's important. When it tells me twice, it's really important. I wonder how important it is when they tell me five times, spread all over the place. I think they're trying to keep guys like me with it. I've got a slight learning disability, or I'd have gotten here before I was 41. Page 143 in the center of the page. If your man accepts your offer, it should be pointed out that physical treatment is but a small part of the picture. Though you're providing him with the best possible medical attention, he should understand that he must undergo a change of heart. All right, so this part's going to have to change. And then it says, to get up a drinker will require, I wonder how important that is, will require a transformation, that's a total change, a transformation of thought and attitude. Page 58. About four lines from the bottom. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Page 42. Let me know if I'm not going fast enough. Page 42, about eight lines from the bottom. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window. Page 27. You stick your finger down in the dead center. This is Carl Jung, arguably the greatest psychologist of all time, talking about us. Put your finger down the dead center of the page. See the word ideas? Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conception motives begin to dominate them. We're operating, by the way, out of fourth editions. I have asked the men that I sponsor to start carrying fourth editions, because that's what our newcomers have got, and they're confused enough. A lot of us. Let's go to page one. And I'm just going to make it easy in case somebody isn't real strong on Roman numerals. You get to page one, turn one page back toward the front of the book in the Roman numerals in the doctor's opinion, and then turn another one. You should see XXIX at the top if you're in a fourth edition. In the third, it will be Roman numeral 27. Paragraph begins near the top of the page with the words, "On the other hand." Count up three lines above that. This is repeated over and over, unless this person can experience an entire, that's more than half, an entire psychic change. There's very little hope of his recovery. Five different places in the book we just located the same concept. And in plain old Tennessee English, what that says is some of what I know for sure ain't so. And the beginning of learning for me was when I was able to release my grip on the things that I knew for sure, to open myself up, as Bob's prayer, to a new experience. I had to release my grip on the thing. I wonder today, with 22 years, how many things I know for sure are actually incorrect. Today, I'm not defending what I believe and what I think. If you disagree with something I have to say, I can't wait to hear from you. Not talk to you, hear from you. Because it'd be a chance for me to learn something. So please, do me the favor. One of my first ones, I was sober about 11 months, and I went to an old-timer at a meeting one night, and I said, "Man, you guys told me that by the time I was sober a year, my sleep patterns would level out, and they haven't. I'm not sleeping." He said, "I just watched you drink two large cups of coffee at an 8 o'clock meeting." I said, "Caffeine doesn't affect me." He said, "If you're pounding out a quart of scotch a day and five joints, it won't." Oh. And so I backed off of the caffeine and been sleeping really good ever since. So, I mean, there was one of them. And by the way, I didn't fly from Nashville, Tennessee to talk to you. I come to talk with you. So we're going to play together tonight. Please join me. A couple of questions for you based on this old ideas thing. I tell you what, let's go to page 61. Slightly past halfway down the page, one of the most powerful concepts in the book. Here's a place, here's a chance to release some old ideas right here. Just below halfway down the page, "Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest," that means to take by force, "wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well?" What that says is that I'm so nuts, I am such a poor observer, that I have failed to notice the thousands of times that I got what I wanted and was not rendered happy. A couple of examples, play with me. Who, when you were a child, wanted a bicycle? You were certain if you could get a bicycle, you would be happy, and you got a bike. Let's see them. Come on. Come on. Okay, you put them down. Are you happy? No? Let's try another one. Try another one, okay? Who wanted him or her? Sure, if you could get them, you'd be happy, and you got them. Let's see it. Let's see it. Okay, now you could be sitting next to him, give you a little break here and not ask the other question. It's only fair. Take a minute. Who was sure if you could get rid of him or her? Huh? Any doubles on that? Okay, good. So, and I try to give you red flags when I go off into my own interpretation instead of what the book says. This is a red flag. My interpretation is I had happiness and pleasure confused. Pleasure is on the physical plane. It is of a limited time duration. And there's something out there that will bring it to me. Happiness is internal. It's on the spiritual plane, and it's a side effect of having a healthy relationship with God and with all of you. And that's in part what the 12 steps are about. That's just a little piece of what it's about. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas. I believe everything I've learned through noon yesterday is now an old idea. I'm trying to hold it in open hand. I'll give you an example from my own experience. At about 2 years, I quit praying for God's guidance. It occurred to me one morning that a loving God was sending that guidance every day. as a free and clear gift. And so what I pray now is that I would be open to His guidance. I believe all the blocks in the channel between me and God are at my end. His end's open, right? My end is where the problem is. Initially, I surrendered. And in the full military context of surrender, that was after the battle and the loud noises and the broken glass, the bleeding and the screaming. That was me bleeding. I was the one screaming. And I surrendered. And I surrendered a lot of times. I haven't surrendered in a long, long time. When I woke up this morning, I did not surrender. I volunteered. If I had closed my mind on the concept of surrender, which was a good one for where I was at that point, I couldn't have built on that. You can't build on that. When I hold surrender in an open hand, I can get to volunteer. I have been to a level above volunteer, and I know people that live at a level beyond that. It's astounding to me. And it's one of the things that keeps me a student in this thing, is watching the people that are further down the path than I am. So I'm holding volunteer in an open hand to see how far that goes. I'm trying to do that with all of the things that I've been given. I had zipped through a 28-day treatment program in 6 weeks flat. They're doing the math. In the summer of 1984, and I went back to Nashville, Tennessee, where the only person I knew in the city was in recovery was one of my customers. I didn't want him to know. For those who don't recognize that, that's newcomer thinking, terminal case. Going to die from this if don't get some help for it. And anyway, I searched for several months for a sponsor. Let's see if you can fill this as two-word, insane newcomer. Insane newcomer looking for a sponsor, two words, fill in blank, I can relate to. Isn't that insane? Isn't that insane? I mean, oh my goodness. I'm squirrely. I got this brain. It's on 9 radio stations at the same time. They're all playing real loud. I'm only hearing a third of what you're saying because in here it's so loud. Who can I relate to? Yeah, I can relate to some other curveball that's nowhere near the strike zone. That's who I can relate to. Oh, thank God I couldn't find a sponsor I could relate to. We'd both be dead by now. And what I stumbled into was a sponsor I would obey. It was a new concept for me. And I didn't really know that's what I had found. But there was a guy in a meeting and his lights were on. You know what I mean? I wanted to feel like this man looked. And I said to him, would you sponsor me? And he said, well, we'll see. Here's your first assignment. Assignment? See, I thought a sponsor is kind of like a big brother going to show you the ropes, maybe loan you some money, fix your wife, that sort of thing. You know? I was wrong about a lot of things. And ask me later. I'm just not going to take the time right now to tell. I may get to it some other time. It took me a week, and I came back, and I said, okay, Jerry, I did the assignment. And he said, I'll sponsor you my way. I started getting really nervous. And I said, what does that mean exactly? And he said, you are too sick to stay sober on the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And I didn't have any idea what the man was talking about. Didn't have a clue. And I was so dry by then, they weren't lighting cigarettes near me. And, I mean, I was just vibrating. And I said, what does that mean? And he gave me what he said was the single best kept secret in all of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the definition of the program. It's on page 59. The way we keep it secret, we read it at almost every meeting. That's how we keep it secret. Right here on page 59, sentence immediately before step one, where it says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Yeah. So the steps, according to Jerry, are not part of the program. The steps are the program. No steps, no program. My great mentor told me, if you take the steps off the wall, you get off the wall program. And anyway, Jerry said, you're going to do the steps at the pace I set, the way I lay them out, or I'm going to drop you like a bad habit. He scared me. But he didn't scare me bad enough. I said, why? When I ask why, I'm never looking for an answer, by the way. I'm looking for a fight. Right? If you'll answer my why question, I'll show you where you're confused. You're just going to give me something to argue with. And he said, I do not answer why questions for the men I sponsor, except for this one. Everybody gets one, and it's this one. And the reason is, step one, section B, says your life's unmanageable. That means you are not in management. And why is a management question. Consequently, all of the why questions have the same answer. And the answer is, you don't need to know. And I hated that when he said it. And today I'm in love with it. It's one of my cornerstones. because I always thought it was not knowing that made me crazy. Mm-mm, it was needing to know that was making me crazy. That was actually one of the ways I played God, was I needed to know. So anyway, I said, why? And he said, think of yourself as a garbage can. Okay, that was easy enough. He said, what we'll do with these steps, we're going to dump you out. We're going to scrub the can and stand it back upright. We're going to fish through your life. And most of it's trash. We're going to toss it. Portions are good. We'll keep them. For example, do you love your children? I said, very much. He said, wonderful. We'll keep that. When we get through with these 12 steps, you're going to be a big, clean, empty can with just a little good stuff in the bottom. Our program's kind of like going to the dentist. We've got to drill before we can fill. That's what steps 4 through 10 are about. They're about digging the poison out of your soul. Because if we just fill with the good stuff, the poison's still in there. One of these days it's going to detonate. But like the dentist, we got Novocaine. We call it sponsorship. We call it home group. We call it fellowship. We call it love. It's not that hard. It's not that hard. And the reason that you have to do this, the answer to your why question is that alcohol is not your problem. What? I said alcohol is not your problem. It's your solution. It's your answer. It's what makes you tall enough, smart enough, good-looking enough, able to talk to the girls, expert on many subjects. Right? Fantastic dancer. Any dancers? Yes. Uh-huh. And just all of a sudden, when that third scotch hits bottom, I'm just okay. It's just okay to be me. And I always wanted to be somebody else. And I didn't much care who. Anybody. I'd have been anybody else. I'd have traded with anybody. Because I was not comfortable in here. Not comfortable. See, if I'm going to live it, I'm stuck in here now. I used to get out all the time. You know what I mean? I mean, you got out too. Right? You told them you were a jet pilot, right? Well, I really was. They didn't believe me either. And if I'm going to live in here all the time, I had to clean it up first so I could stand it. And that's in part what these steps are about. And he said, you're going to have to do these steps. And the reason is because one of these days something heavy is just going to slam into your heart. The example he used, he said, your father's going to die. And on that day, if you don't have that big, empty, clean space, a little good stuff in the bottom, but an empty, clean space to store that pain in, while we love you back to spiritual health, you'll escape. And the only escapes you know are killing you and devastating everyone around you. And I just finally ran out of why. I used to be able to quit. I quit drinking on my own forever a number of times. As you know, forever somewhere between 20 minutes and about 8 weeks. Right? The earth people, don't talk to them. You wouldn't believe how long they think forever is. Oh, my heavens. So I could quit forever, but my problem was I couldn't get unthirsty. This is a piece I could never find on my own. And I would go sometimes 2-3 weeks, a month, and I'm not even thinking about it. But something is always coming to where I'm going to get thirsty again. And I own my own business. So I'm going to close a big deal, make a lot of money. Or I'm going to lose a big deal and lose a lot of money. I'm going to get a new boat, get a new convertible, get a new girlfriend. I'm married, of course. Get a new girlfriend. Or the big one, oh, the Redskins are going to play the Cowboys on Monday night. Jeez. I mean, I'm always going to be thirsty again. So they've been saying to me one day at a time. Do they say one day at a time around here? Some of the things they say. For those of you who are new, there's a second line to that. They're saying it under their breath. I'm going to tell it to you out loud now. Okay, you ready? What they really mean is one day at a time in a row. Right? They actually mean one day at a time in a row with like no breaks at all ever. That's what they mean. Yeah, they're not telling you that, but that's really what they mean. So if I'm going to stay sober one day at a time in a row, I'm going to have this peace. I'm going to have to be rendered permanently unthirsty. And I want to quote for you what I think may be the single most powerful line in the books on page 60. It says 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. You'll hear it read, a result. It's not what it says. It says the. The is singular. It's my experience that spiritually awakened alcoholics do not drink beverage alcohol and they don't ever get thirsty. Ever get thirsty. That's the piece I couldn't find on my own. And anyway, when he finished his little dissertation, I said, well, Jerry, I don't want to do the 12 steps. And he said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, as long as you do them. Jerry, I don't believe we're communicating. He said, sure we are. There's your definition of willingness. Willingness is when I do what my sponsor says, whether I want to or not. He said, did you ever try to get sober on your own? Yeah. How many times? A few thousand. I'm a puker. Any other pukers? There are pukers in the house? Yeah, okay. Your pukers, how about nose pukers? Ever puke out your nose? Anybody ever puke out their nose? Come on, where are you? Nose pukers. These are my people here. Yeah. One of the things you'll notice about your nose pukers is when they're puking out their nose, they tend to quit forever. Right? Right. So I had quit forever well over 2,000 times. And so I had told him that. Yeah, a couple thousand times. And he said that was doing what you wanted to do and not doing what you didn't want to do. I said, well, yeah. He said, well, then that didn't work. So it must be to get sober, you're probably going to have to do some things you'd rather not do and not do some things you kind of like to do. Man was difficult to argue with. And I finally surrendered to him and have had a spiritual awakening as the result. Roman numeral 22. This is the forward to the third edition. It's a couple of pages before the doctor's opinion up toward the front of the book. I'll give you a minute to find that one. This illuminates the description of the steps, I think, for me just a little bit better. Halfway down the page, the basic principles of the AA process, XXII, forward to the third edition, halfway down the page. The basic principles of the AA program, it appears, hold good for individuals of many different lifestyles, just as the program has brought recovery to those of many different nationalities. Here's a very powerful phrase. The 12 steps that summarize the program. So what that says is that the steps I see on the wall are the summary. That's the cliff notes. That's for the guys like me trying to slide with the C-. I got some Fs trying to slide with C-, and I'm scared to get an F here. I must win now. I have to win this time. And I don't care what the price is. I really don't. I will pay it, for I must win now. And then I'm going to skip the foreign language stuff. I'm not that good with it. But you skip down the line. It says, but they trace exactly the same path to recovery. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. So our path is the 12 steps. And then one of my mentors told me that there are two fellowships. I thought that was interesting. There's the fellowship of AA that you're in. When you say you're in it, nobody can say you're not. It's described at the bottom of this page where it says, in spite of the great increase in the size and the span of this fellowship, at its core it remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. That's what we're doing here tonight. That's the fellowship, pardon me, fellowship of AA. The other fellowship is described on page 164. Most of the way down the page. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. Fellowship of the Spirit's got considerably more entrance requirements. Look to me like the steps in narrative form. So the way I get into the fellowship of AA is by saying amen. The way I get into the fellowship of the Spirit is by actually doing the steps. Not understanding the steps or believing them or interpreting them. Surely not interpreting them. Not even believing them. But by actually doing them. He said willingness was more about feet than it was about lips. He says, I don't want to hear it. Show it to me. We're going to train your feet. We get your feet going where they're supposed to go, not going where they're not supposed to go. The rest of you will probably follow along. We'll worry about what's going on inside your head later. Page 96. I can't find the word sponsor or sponsorship in the basic text, but I did find a concept. They've been talking for several pages about a 12-step call. Someone said they wanted some help. You went over there with your big book. You talked about your drinking. They talked about theirs. You laughed a little. You cried a little. You left them a book halfway down the page. Suppose you're now making your second visit to a man. So that was the first. It says he has read this volume and says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. For me, that's someone who's sponsorable. They've made an attempt to read the book. By the way, if you're new, if you had the experience of your eyes moving across the page and your mind moving across the universe, I'll tell you how to stop that. Read out loud. You'll trap your mind in the moment. Trap your mind. So, and I look at me for a second if you would. I love what it says. He says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps. Okay. Great. Great. We'll settle for that. We don't get that many eager ones hopping through the door. So I'm here for a little growth and development. Heard you guys were strong on it. Who can sponsor me? When can we start step four? We don't hear that too often in my home group. So now we've defined for me someone who's sponsorable. He's made an attempt to read the book. He understands the 12 steps are the program, and he's prepared to go through with them. I love that. And then for me, it describes sponsor. It says, having had the experience yourself, you can give him much practical advice. What experience? The experience of going through the 12 steps, what advice? Advice on how to go through the 12 steps. Sponsorship in two sentences. Huh?
Thanks, Scott. So Bob's still an alcoholic? So, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Dash, separate thought, that our lives have become unmanageable. I could sit in meetings in treatment centers, and I did for years, and admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I could admit that I was an alcoholic, and I got to tell you, I had no idea what I'm saying. What I'm really saying, what's really going on inside of me, is I'm in a room full of people that make me nervous, and I pretty much want to go along with you. You know, and I'm just saying what I think you need to hear. So you, because I'm afraid of confrontation. But I don't know what I'm saying when I say I'm an alcoholic. I suspect it has something to do with a drinking problem. But as we will see, it's a lot more than that. On page XXVIII in the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth starts to talk about the aspects of alcoholism, and it's very important for me to know what I got, because you can't deal with a problem that you don't have. And on page XXVII, the top first paragraph, Silkworth says, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Well, he says a couple points here. He's talking about a type of alcoholic, a chronic alcoholic. I think in most illnesses, you have chronic illnesses and you have acute illnesses. An acute illness, like pneumonia, is an acute illness. Pneumonia can kill you. But if you get pneumonia, you can go to a hospital and they'll load you up with antibiotics and they'll knock the pneumonia out and you no longer got pneumonia. You're over it, that's it, done deal. But a chronic illness such as alcoholism, such as certain types of heart disease, such as diabetes, the stabilization of your physical condition is just the beginning of a lifetime process of treatment. And that's why alcoholics of my type, we get real well, and then we get sick. And then we get real well, and then we get sick. Because we don't have an acute condition that you can get. You can't get over this. And I got well a lot of times. As a matter of fact, I got sober a lot of times. I quit drinking a lot of times. I heard one of my favorite first speakers said to me, he said, you know, I quit drinking over 50 times. And he said, every time I ever quit drinking, I'd get sometimes on the worst drunken ever. He says, you know, this quitting drinking was killing me. So we're chronic alcoholics. And he says that the action of alcohol on a guy like me is the manifestation of an allergy. Well, I know about allergies. I'm allergic to cats. I like cats. But if I'm around them after about an hour, what happens is my eyes start to water and my nose starts to run a little bit, and I'm allergic to cats. And it's a phenomenon in the sense that it doesn't happen to most people. There's just a minority portion of the population that react to cats like that. But unlike my allergy to cats, when I drink alcohol, my nose doesn't run and my eyes don't water. I break out in what Silkworth refers to here as this phenomenon of craving. Well, I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as a young kid in the mid-70s listening to people talk about the phenomenon of craving, and I don't get it. I mean, I get that I'm in trouble. I get that I drink and get drunk, but I don't connect it with a craving. And the odd thing about a craving is you don't realize you have it until you can't satisfy it anymore. Everybody in this room right this moment is in the grip of a craving you're not aware of. And that's the craving to breathe air. If someone were to slip up behind you with a plastic bag and put it over your head, you'd instantly realize, I got this craving to breathe air, because you can no longer satisfy it. And one of the reasons I couldn't see the phenomenon of craving in me is that I think somewhere I must have, not consciously, but intuitively understood that. So I avoided situations where I could just have two or three and then could not get any more. Now, I don't do it because I think I'm an alcoholic. It just, you know, if I went somewhere and you only had a six-pack of beer between a couple guys, it's, why? I mean, you know, I'm going to pass. You go ahead, help yourself, enjoy. You had three, four cases, I'm with you. And so I had a hard time identifying the phenomenon of craving until I was sitting in a meeting in the mid-70s listening to a woman share her experience about a dinner party, and I remembered something that had happened to me when I was 18 years old. And here's what I remember. I'm 18 years old, I'm dating a gal, and she invites me over to her parents' house to meet her family. And I'm going to be there all night. I go, I feel awkward, you know, I've always been a little overly self-conscious anyway and feel like people are looking at me anyway, but I go trying to be a good guy. And we're sitting down at the dinner table and they bring out a bottle of wine. Not a big bottle of wine. This is just a little bottle. Not the kind of bottle of wine we would buy. This is like an Al-Anon bottle of wine. Right? And they pour us all a glass of this bottle of wine and set it on the table. Well, I've always drank quickly. I don't know what that's about. I think evaporation's a childhood issue with me or something. I don't know. But I drink quickly. Because I drink quickly, I've killed two glasses out of that bottle of wine. They're still sipping on the first glass and the bottle's dead. And I'm sitting there, I'm 18 years old. When I was 18 years old, you could have put me in a lie detector and said, Bob, is there any way in the world you might have alcoholism? I would have said, no, absolutely not. And I'm telling you, the lie detector would have said I was telling the truth. But I was just as alcoholic at that dinner table that day as I am today. But I couldn't see it. And I'm sitting there and I'm squirrely and I don't know what's wrong with me and I want another glass of wine. And I finally said to him, I said, God, that was good wine. Do you have any more? And they said, no. And they went back to talking about sports and Vietnam and a bunch of crap. And I'm sitting in there and I'm, you know how you talk to yourself in your head? Oh, it's getting a little panicky in here. And I'm like spinning in here. And I finally blurted out, I said, you know, I sure like beer. And they said, well, we don't have any beer, Bob. Next time you come over, we'll get you some beer. It'll be fine. They went back to talking. And I'm sitting there. I think I'm going to lose my mind. I don't know what's wrong with me. I finally excuse myself. I go to their bathroom. I lock the door. And I go like a crazy person. I go through all the cabinets. Found a bottle of cough medicine that was 35% alcohol with codeine and terpenhydrate, which is a bonus. And I sat there on the edge of that bathtub and I chugged that bottle of cough medicine and it was like my head just went, oh, and slowed down and I could think straight. And I sat there and all of a sudden I could come up with a plan, and I went back out to that dinner table and I explained to them about this thing I'd forgotten to take care of. And I was really sorry I had to leave, and they were a little disappointed, sorry I had to leave. And I went and got in my car and drove down their street. The way you're supposed to, 20, 25 miles an hour, got to the end of their street, turned the corner, drove like a crazy person, 70, 80 miles an hour, to get to a friend of mine's house who had an open bar in his basement, because I'd had two glasses of wine. And it lit something up inside of me that demanded attention. And it wasn't until I could identify what happens to me when I drink and am cut off that I could start to glimpse the phenomenon of craving. Just to glimpse it. Now, Silkworth says that this reaction never occurs in the average temper drinker. It didn't. None of those other people at that dinner table were alcoholics. If they'd have been alcoholics, we'd all been in that damn bathroom going through those cabinets. But something happens to me that didn't happen to them. And it's this reaction to alcohol, this that makes me an alcoholic. If you've ever sat and watched a non-alcoholic drink, my sister is not an alcoholic, and I've watched my sister drink. I've watched my sister drink like a cat will watch a guy eat a tuna fish sandwich. I mean, I've even looked in her eyes waiting for to see the effect come over, you know. I mean, I really get into it, you know. And my sister, about halfway through the second drink, she starts to feel it. She starts to get that warm glow. And as it starts to come on her, in her wiring, which, by the way, is normal, non-alcoholic wiring, as she starts to feel the buzz and the glow inside of her, it goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. She shuts it right down. Right down, she shuts it right down. Because she gets to feeling like she's losing control. I take a couple drinks of alcohol, and as the feeling starts to come over, it starts to light me up, and everything in me says, oh, yeah. Oh, come on, come on, come on. And I can't get enough. I can't get enough. That feeling starts to hit me, it's not so much that it takes me there, but it takes me to a place where I can almost touch it. With a feeling like maybe on the next drink, I'm going to be there. So keep them coming. Keep them coming. I get a feeling, I don't get a feeling like I'm losing control. I get a feeling like I'm about to get control. Like everything in me kind of shores up and just gets better and more complete. My sister just gets drunk. I don't get drunk. I get so wonderful that I'm about to blow the mind of the universe. And so I can't stop once I start. I drank a lot of years. I tell you, I have never once been sitting in a bar drinking for a half hour at a party or anywhere and had somebody come up to me and say, Bob, would you like another drink? I've never once sat there and kind of thought to myself and thought, nah, this is just right. Not once. You'd think a guy like me would have one experience like that. So I don't have one experience where it's just right. Now, I have experiences where I'll stop because pressure's on. You're looking at me funny. Somebody's on my back about my drinking. But I've never stopped because, oh, this is enough. This is just right. It's always one more. Matter of fact, I'm the guy, I can drink myself till I'm laying on the floor and I can't get up. But if you would bring me a drink, I would really be much obliged. As long as I'm conscious, I ain't done drinking once I start. So I got that thing. And Silkworth goes on to say, these allergic types, guys like me, we can't safely use alcohol in any form at all. Now, what I'm about to say is not the opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it is my personal experience with myself and with a lot of guys that I've sponsored over the years. I think that my very life depends upon me identifying all these forms of alcohol. And maybe for some of you, it's vodka, beer, rum, whiskey, wine. And maybe for some of us, in my experience, it's vodka, beer, whiskey, wine, Ativan, Percodan, whatever. Anything that lights my spirit up. Eventually I'm the guy who's drunk and pitiful again. It's like letting a tiger out of the cage that I can't get back into the cage. Now, I'll tell you something I've observed, and maybe if you're an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous, you may have observed this to some degree in your own community. In the last 15 years of people I've seen relapse with that were real alcoholics, and I'm not talking about people who came here and they were really drug addicts. I'm talking about alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous who were really alcoholics and knew they couldn't drink. Of the people who went back to drinking, I'd say over half of them had started with something other than alcohol. They knew they couldn't drink. It was killing them. But it doesn't say anything in the book about smoking this stuff, does it? And I can't safely use alcohol in any form at all. Not safely. And he goes on to say, once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That's so true. What happens to me, and I think a lot of us, is that the wreckage of my alcoholism is so overwhelming, I can't even see what's killing me, because I can't see past the problems that have occurred as a result of my drinking. There are times when the sun and the moon are in the sky at the same time. And actually, at those times, the moon has a stronger pull on the earth, on the tides and on everything here. It has more of an influence than the sun, because it's closer. But when the sun and the moon are in the sky at the same time, you can't even see the moon because the sun is so glaring. And alcoholism is often like that. Sometimes it lurks in the shadow of all the wreckage. It's underneath. It's the thing that's causing all this. And I don't get it. So what happens to me is I get sober and I'm up to here in problems. So I want to start fixing the problems. Almost with an attitude when people come up to me and say, listen, you need to do AA. You need to get a sponsor of these steps. This is really the big deal. And I go, yeah. Look, once I get all this other stuff straightened out, I'll do AA. Hey, I may join a gym too. Who knows? But I'm going to get, I got this stuff is really the big deal here. And so what happens, I fix all this stuff and sometimes I get most of it fixed. Sometimes I get half of it fixed. But whatever, is I always end up drinking again. Because I'm never addressing as a concrete piece of business what's really the problem. I'm addressing the symptoms, some symptoms that change all the time. I think to be a practicing alcoholic is often like a guy living in a station wagon 24/7. And he's partying. And as things occur, traffic tickets, court dates, family responsibilities, appointments, IRS. He's too busy. He just throws him in the back of the maybe next week. And then when you get sober, it's like running that station wagon into a brick wall, and in slow motion out of the back comes all this stuff. And you're 30 days sober, and the fog starts to clear, and that is not necessarily good news. Because all of a sudden you realize you're up to here in problems, emotional problems. I don't know why I had these roller coaster feelings and feelings of depression, mental problems. I got a head that just spins on me and just chatters to me crazily all the time about weird stuff, and none of it's good. It's never good. My head, I don't wake up with a joyous thoughts running in my head. No, it's always the end of the world. They're out to get you. You might as well drink. It's always that way. I got police problems. I got finance problems. I got living problems. I got emotional, mental problems. I got family problems. I got a wealth of remorse and guilt problems. And I can't see what's killing me. I can just see the symptoms. The bottom of page XXVIII, Silkworth starts to lead us into what the real nature of the beast is, what we really treat in Alcoholics Anonymous. See, if the phenomenon of craving was all there was to alcoholism, then like a treatment center would solve your problem. They would say to you, they would educate you. They'd bring you to a point where you'd get it. Oh yeah, okay, I don't take the first one. Good to go now, thank you. Then that Nancy Reagan Just Say No program would work for you. And alcoholics can say no. I said no a lot. No. No. No, and I'm not smoking anything. No, I'm going to pass on the pills. No. No, I'm not. No, no. I know it's organic wine. No. 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 I said no. Don't even ask me no more. No. Can't you understand? No. I'm sober now. I'm a grateful member of AA. No. No. Well, all right. Okay. And for an alcoholic of my type, there is a yes in every barrel of no's. And why is that? Why does a guy like me, who is not stupid and not self-destructive really, even though it looks that way, Why do I swear to myself and mean it with every fiber of who I am that I'm never going to touch that again? And 7 or 8 or 10 or 6 or 4 months later, sometimes 3 weeks later, I'm back at it. Silkworth starts to solve the riddle a little bit in the bottom of the page. He says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I think that's true for everybody. My sister drinks because she likes the effect. She doesn't like a lot of it, but she likes it. She likes a little bit of it. I don't think I so much drink because I like it. I think somewhere, secretly, I need it. I think one of the problems that I face is that without it, I'm nothing. Without it, I'm not doing too well. Without it, I don't fit very well. Without the effect of alcohol, I suffer from low-level depressions, bouts of anxiety, and this awful feeling of anxious apartness. Have you ever had this feeling of... I've sat in the middle of rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous surrounded by people who I know want to help me and are there for me, and yet still felt like it's all of you and then there's me. As if for some reason there's some sort of barrier between me and you that I can't surmount or break through. And so I drink again. I drink again because I don't understand what's wrong with me. I drink again because I desperately want the effect I'd once found in taking a few drinks. Silkworth goes on to say that the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. Everybody's been there. I don't know an alcoholic that's ever came to AA and finally got sober that doesn't have some points in their past where they sat somewhere hungover or sick or in jail or something saying, man, I've got to stop this. We say that a lot. We've got to that point a lot. We admit that it's injurious. We get it. We're not stupid people. I knew years before I got sober that this is burning my life to the ground. I knew years before I got sober that this is bad. But I keep at it. And Silkworth says I can't differentiate the true from the false because in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't talk about denial. They'll tell you that. That's a word they'll throw at you at those treatment centers. We don't even go there. We have something more insidious. It's called self-delusion. And if you don't know what that is, self-delusion, it's a psychotic, wishful thinking. It's all the evidence is that this is killing you and it's bad, but I don't want it to be bad. I want it to be good like it was when I was 20 years old, and I want it to be like that so bad that I start to imagine that it is to the point where I believe it. Isn't it funny how the last couple of years of our drinking, we'll go out again and drink with an anticipation of how much fun it's going to be in spite of the reality. It hasn't been fun like that for 3 or 4 years. It's turned on us. It's pathetic now, but yet is how after 6 months of sobriety, I'll start fantasizing it's going to be like it was when I was 20 years old in face of an absolute ability to roll it back to that point. I will imagine I can when I can't. I can't differentiate the true from the false. I have the psychotic wishful thinking. I have the self-delusion. Because I need so desperately and yearn for that effect so desperately. I got a letter here written to Bill Wilson in 1960 from Carl Jung, a great psychiatrist. Scott mentioned him earlier. Very influential in the forming of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this letter, the first time I read this, it really struck me. This guy knows something. And he hits something very powerful. He's writing this letter to Bill, and in it he says, I had no news from Roland H. anymore and often wondered what had been his fate. Our conversation, which he has adequately reported to you and had an aspect of which he didn't know. The reason that I could not tell him everything was that in those days I had to be exceedingly careful of what I said. I had found out that I was misunderstood in every possible way. Thus I was very careful when I talked to Roland. But what I really thought about was the result of many experiences with men of his kind. That his craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of his being for wholeness, for unity, or as expressed in medieval religious terms, a union for God. I drank alcohol and yearned and thirsted, not for the beverage, but for the effect. I thirsted for the effect. Because there was a time in my life when a guy who doesn't fit very good, who doesn't really feel like other people look, who seems to be incomplete and awkward, who suffers from low-level depressions and anxiety, could have 4 or 5 drinks and I could come out and play. 7 drinks and I loved everybody. Remember that feeling? I love you, man. Oh, I used to hang with this guy, this gang of guys, and we'd pass a bottle of wine around. Man, about halfway through this half gallon of wine, I felt so connected to them, I almost brought tears to my eyes. Man, these are my guys. And then I'd sober up and I'm back to being me again. The guy who doesn't quite fit very good. The guy who's depressed and moody and awkward and clumsy at life. I yearned for that effect. I thirsted for it. And why? Silkworth says, to them their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. My big secret is that in the early days of my drinking, I felt more normal when I'm screwed up than I ever felt when I was not screwed up. And some of you have been in a couple treatment centers, and they'll tell you when you get to a treatment center, they'll say, and you usually end up there, you're not in good shape, and they'll say to you, you know, you're really screwed up. And you go, yeah, I know, yeah. And they say, you know why you're screwed up? I don't know. Well, you're really screwed up because you keep getting screwed up. If you'd stop getting screwed up, you wouldn't be so screwed up, and you're desperate. You think, okay, I'm going to stop getting screwed up. And I stop getting screwed up. And when I stop getting screwed up, I'm really screwed up. And I can't pay. I get so screwed up not getting screwed up that I got to go get screwed up because I'm screwed up when I don't get screwed up. And if you understand that, you are screwed up. I'm telling you. You try to explain that at a PTA meeting, they just look at you. But that's alcoholism. And it's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. When they say it's cunning, baffling, and powerful, it's baffling. You know, why do we keep returning to, like a moth to a flame to this? And Silkworth really hits it here. He says, he's talking about us when I quit drinking. And here's what happens to me when I quit drinking. He says, I'm restless. I'm irritable, and I'm discontented, unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort, which at one time came from taking a few drinks. Remember the ease and comfort? Remember the first drink after a period of absence when you're up to here with life and every cell in your body would just go, it's like you could take your first real breath. Oddly enough, in Latin, the word spirit means the breath of life. And if something's wrong with our spirit, so we take spirits because we yearn for the breath of life. I'm locked up without it. So I stop drinking, and for all practical purposes, my alcoholism starts where the bag and the bottle ends. I go into a state of abstinence, and in the beginning, I'm sweating it out, shaking it out. So I don't know what's going on. But then after I get over the physical thing, what starts to happen to me is that the further away I am from the last drink, when you would think I should be getting more comfortable, and maybe I am externally, but inside me, where I really live, I become progressively more restless, irritable, and discontent. When I say restless, it's not a big restless like where they got to put you in a straitjacket. All this stuff often is subtle and goes right below the radar. It's just it's a vague restlessness. It's a feeling like I don't know where I'm supposed to be. I don't know. I just know it's not here. Now, I don't know where it is, but it's just never a sense like this is it. Did you ever watch a dog circle a room trying to find its spot to lay down? I'm a dog who can't find its spot. There's an aimlessness about me. And I'm irritable. And I don't mean to be. But you take alcohol out of my life, if you don't give me some kind of alternative medication or something, I'll tell you, it's not that I'm irritable, really. It looks like I am. But what really happens is I just become so aware of what's wrong with everybody. I just see it. I mean, man, it's just so clear to me. And because I'm restless, you got to tell them about it. And that makes abstinence a lonely business. Because people rub me the wrong way. I become the judgmental monster. And I just know what's wrong with everybody. I quit jobs because I start building every time I get to a new job or a new group, I start building the cases against, start noticing, till I'm the guy that's walled off. And then the last thing he says is discontented. I think alcoholism is a disease of chronic malcontent. I don't know what it is about me that the shine of stuff wears off so quickly. You know, and it's like I go through my life and there's this vacancy, this emptiness right in the center of who I am. And I don't know what it's about. I don't understand it. It makes me crazy. And I just, my head just spins trying to figure it out. Sometimes it looks like it's a Harley Davidson shaped hole, I'm sure. Or it's a relationship-shaped hole. Oh, yes, it must be that. Or it's a money-shaped hole. So what happens to me is I develop a case of the when-I's. I'm not really happy, but I will be when I get that promotion. When I get that relationship. When I get rid of that relationship. When I get the house. And no matter what I bring to me, the shine of it wears off so quickly. It's like my only hope. I remember sitting in AA meetings in the years I was in and out, watching the people in AA in their nice new cars and stuff bring the meetings into the institutions I was in. And they would talk about how wonderful their life was sober. And I would think, well, yes, of course. Of course you're sober. If I had everything that you had, if I was... Well, the real problem is I could be happy sober, but I'm not properly financed. If I was properly financed... And I had some reasonable people around me, not the idiots that are around now, but some reasonably smart, sensitive, understanding people. I could be sober. So what I think, I'm deluded into thinking that I could create sobriety through proper acquisition. And as if I could maybe stay sober the rest of my life if I was rich enough to arrange my life in a non-stop series of self-gratification events, like one right after another. Like a new car every third day, a new relationship every third day, a new motorcycle once a week, maybe a trip around the world every 3 weeks. You know, but you know what happens to guys? There are people that are rich like that can do that. You know what happens after a couple years of that? They stick pistols to their head and they blow their brains out. And that is not... A rare thing that happens, that is actually happens quite often. Chuck Chamberlain, one of my great mentors, along with Don, the guy that Scott talked about, used to say that eventually the alcoholic will get to a place where you can no longer put anything between you and you. And you get to the end of that string and you got everything. And it ain't no good. And some of us have learned a very painful lesson. No matter how good we get it out here, if it ain't good here, if it ain't good on the inside, it ain't no good. So I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. Unless I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And after I run to my string of all the self-gratification stuff that doesn't include alcohol, alcohol is the last thing in the row. Eventually it gets back to that. And what happens is I pick up a drink. The book says I succumb to the desire again, as so many do. The phenomenon of craving develops. I passed through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. Oh, I've done that so many times. This time I mean it. The book says this is repeated over and over and over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. That's the main purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, to create an internal rearrangement so I become something I can't imagine I could ever be, a guy that's comfortable sober. Something must wake up within me. Now, one quick thing I'm going to cover before we take a break. There's another dynamic that occurs in alcoholism that makes guys like me relapsers, that I can make up my mind I'm never going to drink again, and I always do. And on page 24, the first full paragraph in italics, it talks about another piece of the puzzle. Because if all it was the phenomenon of craving, so in other words, you just don't take the first drink, and then you have this neurosis, this restless, irritable discontent, maybe you could live with that. But there's another factor that makes it almost inevitable that alcoholics of my type will drink again. And it says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. And then here's the kicker. It says, we are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness, to bring into my mind, with sufficient force, the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, or without defense against the first drink. If I can't do that for a week or a month ago, how am I going to do it for 6 months, or 6 years, or 26 years, or 50 years? How you can't do it? And it's a phenomenon that I think what happens is, the further I get away from the pain and suffering of the last run, at the end of the run, the memory of the pain becomes vague and hazy on an emotional, experiential level. Now, I can remember it intellectually. I can remember, oh, yeah, I was in detox. Oh, yeah, I was arrested. Oh, yeah, I was really sick. But, you know, after a while, it gets a little vague. I mean, as far as having any kind of emotional impact on you. I'm told by women in AA that it's a very similar dynamic to what happens with childbirth. If a woman could really experientially bring up the pain of childbirth, she would never, ever do that again. And what happens is you get away from it, and you sort of intellectually remember it, but you don't, not experientially. And you start seeing the cute little babies, or in our case, the guys that are dancing and drinking and having fun and laughing, and then there's me. And the memory of the pain becomes hazier. Now, that in itself wouldn't get me to drink again, because I could surround myself by people in AA. Except that the other thing that Silkworth talks about happens at the same time. So let's say I just got out of a treatment center. I'm still licking my wounds. I may go to jail. I don't know what's going on. My commitment to sobriety is strong. If my abstinence were on a balanced scale, like a teeter-totter, it has a lot of weight, man. I just got through kicking that stuff. I'm never going to go back to that again. Strong commitment to my own abstinence. The memory's fresh of the pain. On the other side of the balance scale, or some feelings of restless, irritable, discontent, little low-level depression, but really nothing as of yet compared to, man, you know, I almost died. And then what happens is time goes on, the memory of the pain gets vaguer and hazier, and the feelings of restless, irritable, and discontent get stronger and more pronounced. My sponsor says it's like someone has planted a spring in the pit of your stomach. And day in and day out, they just crank it a little tighter and a little tighter. And the people at work don't understand how hard I'm trying. And the family still treats me like a child. And the traffic, don't they realize I'm in a hurry? And it just gets tighter and tighter. And this becomes heavier, the restless, irritable discontent, the low-level depression, The feelings of what I've come to understand are the malady of the spirit. I start becoming sick in here. And this gets heavier, and this gets lighter, and the balance thing starts to shift. And then one day, a week before, it was unthinkable to ever take another drink. It's like a key turns in our head. And it seems like a reasonable idea again. And that is insane. In the light of what it always does for us. So if you're an alcoholic of my type, without the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and without this connection with some kind of power through that step, those steps, the question is not if you're going to drink again. The question is simply when. I think it's an inevitability that you're going to drink again or take some medication or become a workaholic or a compulsive gambler, or you're going to sit doing porno on the internet for 7 hours a day till you die of dehydration or whatever. I don't know. But something, you have an itch that you will scratch. Take a break?
12 minutes, 10 seconds.
12-minute, 10-second break.
Good evening. My name's Scott Lee, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from the Backroom Group in Nashville, Tennessee. It's my home group, and I'm proud to have a home group. I have a trusted servant position in my home group. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor some guys, and I believe in this thing we do. I read 2 pages a day in the big book. Been doing it for about 20 years. I'm not trying to show off, but when I flip through the book, it's because I've read it enough to where I can find it. It's the only way I know to study it. I'd like to open this session with a quotation from the great American philosopher Hank Williams Sr. I guess you have to be from Nashville. Who said, a lot of good ideas in a pint, not so many in a quart. And it's because that was my experience with it. I got here, and what I wanted to do was to work the promises and hope the steps came true. Yeah, and if you're new and you've looked at the steps and they look like they're designed to punish you, welcome to AA. That's how they look to us, and we were wrong about that, and there's a pretty good chance that you are too. I want to talk a little bit. Bob was talking about this phenomenon of craving, and I want to talk about my own experience with it. In October of 1966, I entered the United States Air Force as a second lieutenant, was sent to actually Valdosta, Georgia, not that far from here, to Air Force pilot training. And in the last half of pilot training, we flew the T-38, which, although you may not know it, you're familiar with. In the movie Top Gun, they had a dogfight with the MiGs. All right, the Russian government didn't loan Hollywood any MiGs, all right? And that black airplane's the T-38, the Air Force's advanced jet trainer, it still is. It was a very hot airplane. The Thunderbirds flew it for 7 years. It's a supersonic aircraft. It has afterburning jet engines. It is stressed with 7.5 positive Gs and about 4 negative Gs. You take the runway on this thing, you lock the canopy, you lock the bridge. You're wearing a G-suit, a flight suit, a parachute, helmet, visor, oxygen mask. You're sitting on a 20-millimeter cannon shell. If you raise the handles and squeeze the triggers, it will blow you out of there. Lock the canopy, you lock the brakes, you run it up to military power, you release the brakes, and you light the burners. About a mile later, at about 170 miles an hour, you think back pressure, and the nose wheel comes off, and it flies off, and you raise the gear. At 1,000 feet, you raise the flaps, and you begin to apply forward pressure on the stick. And you have to hold it down at that because it wants to climb bad. And at 600 knots, you pull it up, and you're level at 40,000 feet, 3.5 minutes from brake release. Yeah, wow is correct. Let me tell you that they ain't got that right at the fair. You're not going to find that one. This thing has a roll rate of 720 degrees a second. It does a loop, a 5G loop, 10,000 feet, 500 knots, pull up at 5 Gs. And what that means is that you weigh 5 times what you weigh right now. So a 200-pound man weighs 1,000 pounds at 5 Gs. Everything, that includes your upper eyelids. Believe me, you work to keep them open at 5 Gs. 10,000 feet, 500 knots, we pull up. We're wings level inverted at 20,000 feet. And we lose 8,000 feet coming down the backside in less than 25 seconds. And I tell you all of that about the alcoholism, about the airplane, because, to tell you about my alcoholism. Actually, I tell you for 2 reasons. The other one is to impress you. anybody? Yeah, meet your minds up. And Because I come down from a day of flying that airplane, and I head over to the officers' club to socialize with the other pilots in my squadron. Do not plan to get drunk this particular evening. Used to get drunk on purpose a lot. That's why I'm going out. But did you ever get drunk by mistake? Was anybody ever accidentally drunk? Do you know what I mean? Yeah, that would happen to me. And I tell you what, let's try. This is a big. Would you be willing to audience participation with me? Now let's try that again. Would you be willing to audience participation? Yes, thank you very much. I'm going to cue you. Just fill in the blank. You know the answers. Okay. By the way, I have a flight tomorrow morning at 7:30 in this airplane to do acrobatics. Nobody with a brain would get drunk the night before going to do that. Would you buy that? Okay. I'm going to drop by the club. I'm going to have one beer, no more than... Right. I noticed some of the Al-Anons didn't play. Now, dadgummit. Now, listen up. Listen up. Trust yourself. You know these answers. This is what you heard on the phone. Right? And you believed it again. That's why you have to come to Al-Anon. Because the ones that ran screaming from guys like me don't have to come to your thing, do they? No, they don't. Okay. So chime in. You know all this. Okay? I'm going to have one beer, no more than... Should be home by 6:30, no later than... But what happens is somewhere between the first sip of the first beer and the bottom of the second one, I get this phenomenon of craving Dr. Silkworth talks about. And I don't get home at 7. I leave the office of the club at exactly 1 o'clock in the morning because they...
close.
Quite a few pilots here, Bob. And drive home with a hand over one eye.